Good morning. Welcome back. This is Reverend Andrew Black, Earthkeepers 360. And of course, we are grateful to have everybody joining us this morning. We want to give a shout out, of course, again to all the graduates, whether that's from Santa Fe High, Capitol High, or University of New Mexico, all the different high schools around here, my alma mater, St. Mike's. And of course, want to give a shout out to Jaden Carrillo, who graduated from Santa Fe High yesterday, as well as Sam Mitchell. And of course, give a little bit of a shout out to all of those who have graduated from kindergarten. We've got a special guest real quick here. Can you say your name into the microphone?
Brooke.
Brooke is my daughter, and she graduated from where?
Wood Gormley.
Yeah, she's at Wood Gormley, and you just finished what year?
Kindergarten.
So, Brooke, we're grateful to have you. Want to give a shout out to all of the kids who are graduating from kindergarten. You know, would be remiss as a dad if I didn't have Brooke on just to give a little bit of a shout out to all her classmates. And so, of course, we are super grateful to everybody who's getting their education, who's moving on, and just how important you all are, and to let you all know that you matter. So, some folks this week have asked me to talk a little bit about Earthkeepers and to talk about how we came to be and what Earthkeepers 360 really is and what kind of work we're doing. And so, I was going to give a little bit of an intro, but I really want to hand it over to the brains and the wisdom of the operation after that. So Earthkeepers 360, how we formed and came to be was I helped organize and lead a trip of 40 faith leaders from Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado to meet with tribal leaders to protect Bears Ears National Monument back in 2016. And I formed Earthkeepers 360 really after that to kind of work with spiritual leaders and faith communities and tribal leaders on conservation issues all over the United States. And it's really about working to protect public lands, water, wildlife, and also on climate. And so, you know, our work has kind of grown over the years, and we've got over, I think, 300 to 400 different spiritual leaders and congregations across the country that kind of tune into us and work with us. But also, at the same time, we are housed out of First Presbyterian Church as a mission of that church. And it's really a creation care mission of how do we live and be in, good stewards of God's creation? How do we understand that as part of our faith values? And how do we, you know, work with loving our neighbors and loving God's creation? And how do we carry ourselves in the world, whether that's from the pulpit or the pew? And so as a Presbyterian minister, ordained Presbyterian minister myself, I obviously head up a lot of that work, and I'm oftentimes the forward-facing part of the organization with myself and Carmichael Dominguez, who does our Hispano organizing, and Brophy Toledo, who does a lot of our tribal organizing. He's a spiritual leader out of Jemez Pueblo. And so the really cool thing is that Earthkeepers also embodies that kind of tricultural reality, whether you're working with mainline Protestant traditions here in the Southwest, or you're working with Hispanic communities on acequia and water issues, or you're working with tribal communities on protection of places like the Caja del Rio. So the really cool thing is we also work nationwide. And so over the years, I've worked with a chaplain in Georgia to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a Presbyterian congregation in Florida to save sensitive coastlines in the Tampa Bay around Dunedin, Florida, evangelical Christians in Arkansas to protect old growth forests, and the San Carlos Apache to protect Oak Flat in Arizona, as well as working with nuns here in New Mexico on oil and gas issues, and as well as in Texas. So we work on a wide variety of issues, and also things like Chaco Canyon, right? And many of you all know that Chaco Canyon's under threat. There's a bigger conversation about to remove the kind of buffer around Chaco Canyon and the impact that that would have to the culture, the religion, the spirituality of many of our Pueblo sisters and brothers. And at the same time, what does it mean to live in New Mexico as the land of enchantment if we don't protect our land, our water, and our wildlife? And who are we as a people? And so that's a lot of the work that we do. But we also work with veterans and disadvantaged youth to get them outdoors, whether that's through fly fishing trips, camping trips, and opportunities to kind of reconnect with the land, the water, and the wildlife, and of course with creation and something greater than ourselves. And so I wanted to bring on one of my favorite people, and of course I'm incredibly biased because it's my wife, Jennifer Black, who is really the brains and the wisdom behind the operation of Earthkeepers 360. And one of the things that Jennifer reminded me of yesterday, and I think is so important, especially in our community, is that, you know, I always say that gratitude is free. You can give as much of you as you want in your entire life, and there's no limitation on it. You can always be as thankful as you want, whether that's to other people, whether that's to the creator, or whether that's just for the beauty of creation. And so gratitude in life is free, and there's no limit to how much you can give. And so it's always really good to, I think, to be grateful as kind of a spiritual discipline. But one of the things my wife reminded me of yesterday is she said, gratitude is freely given. Credit is taken. And so it was something that I think is so important that, you know, credit tends to be one of those kind of ego things that we really strive for and we want to be acknowledged. But that sense of always trying to recognize the people behind the scenes and have, be grateful for them. And one of those people, of course, is my wife, Jennifer Black, who really does help kind of keep the engine of Earthkeepers 360 going, not only here in New Mexico, but nationwide. And so she's the director of operations. She's a marine biologist by training and has also been a teacher here in the Santa Fe Public Schools, teaching at Capitol High, Santa Fe High, and of course the New Mexico School for the Arts. So Jennifer, welcome to the radio program this morning. I was hoping you could talk to us a little bit about Earthkeepers and a little bit about your background.
All right, sure. Well, you've done a good job with the Earthkeepers portion of it. And I just want to make one little emphasis. Usually when people hear about Earthkeepers, they talk about like the mission. And our mission starts with equipping spiritual leaders with tools needed to effectively engage modern environmental issues. And so typically when you think about spiritual leaders, you think about rabbis and priests and ministers and deacons and elders, people with like formal titles. But the one thing that I really like to engage people with is their own responsibility, their own voice and their role as a steward. And if you're acting with your faith and your spirituality, then you are that spiritual leader. So it's really empowering our congregations and our lay people as well to be that grassroots movement. So for myself, I'm an environmentalist, marine biology training. I grew up in Chicago, and then we moved over to Singapore. So it was really that moment when we were in Singapore. We did a lot of traveling. I was influenced mainly by this environmental artist called Robert Wyland, and he was known for his whaling walls, and he made these life-size murals to bring attention to environmental issues affecting the ocean. So I realized that that's something I wanted to do. And between that and a teacher who was not actually my teacher, she was an ESL teacher named Catherine Frazier. She was the teacher liaison for a club that we started, a recycling program at my high school. Now I went to the Singapore American School, and we've started recycling programs all over the country in different schools that I taught at. But the one thing that was unique about this one, and it was really led by her son, Robert Frazier, we created a recycling program in a country that didn't have the resources or the infrastructure to recycle. So we partnered with another country, Malaysia, and our program became a huge success. Our campus, we used to have two or three campuses, and we consolidated to one campus. So it was kind of easy and scalable to do our recycling program. And with our partnerships, I think we kind of got the country of the Republic of Singapore a little jealous. And so they instituted a new model, and they got on the bandwagon. And so our little high school project, our empowerment of students, ended up changing the culture of an entire country. Whether it was out of jealousy or whatnot.
Competition.
They didn't want to get shown up by a bunch of high schoolers. So here we are, and we're creating real change. And so that's sort of how I got into education as well. Empowering the young people to make a difference in their community. Because they have that spirit, that fire. And how do you flame that in the right direction?
Yeah, that's such an amazing story. And it's one of the things that I learned, obviously, through the course of our relationship, and this idea of, you know, how this small high school literally shifted an entire nation to engage in recycling because of your leadership and because of the leadership of other faculty and students. And I think that's something that also speaks to this week, as many of the students are graduating and wanting to know how to make a difference in this world, and knowing how this world can oftentimes feel like it's on fire. And yet you're giving a very practical example to those students and to those families about how, you know, a small group of people with a passion and a vision and a sense of, you know, bucking some of the culture around you to make a difference for the environment. And I think that's a really powerful lesson and a story to remind a lot of the students that are in our local community about. And I, you know, I just also want to talk a little bit about this, you know, some of what Earthkeepers does, what some of our work, you know, talk a little bit about the weekly reflections that we do and how folks get involved in that. And then, you know, some of the bigger projects that we're working on.
Sure. So we have a weekly reflection, and this is, taking a variety of voices in our community, both religiously based as well as environmentalists. We take quotes and inspiration from them and create reflection questions that you can take personally and reflect on how you're living your life and how you want to change and make modifications in your life, as well as it's great conversation starters for congregations. So we have many churches around the country that use this, and they implement some of these questions in their Bible studies, their sermon writings, and kind of pepper it throughout their community. And with great response, we get a lot of feedback from these spiritual leaders and our viewership. We have about 400 recipients every week in 28 states. So we're out there in a variety of different environments and ecosystems and communities. And each week we have a take action. Those take actions help people figure out how to channel their energy and which ways, what environmental issues are becoming emergent, which ones need our support, and how to make a difference locally and nationally. We also have Earth Care Tidbits, just basic things that you can take to heart and how you can make a small change and what kind of impact that might have. On a larger scale, some things that we're working on right now is the Kaha campaign. We are also working with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We are
Chaco Canyon.
We're doing Oak Flats. We're working on a lot of different sacred grounds that are being under attack and how to preserve them, both ecologically and spiritually and for the culture and use of the people surrounding. We also have some stuff locally. We have a zero waste campaign. So with that, Santa Fe and a lot of our communities already recycle curbside, but there's some things that go to the landfill that really don't need to. So we have a couple locations. We have drop-off locations at First Presbyterian Church in Santa Fe, as well as the Santa Fe Children's Museum. And we recycle things that are hard, that you can't throw into the curbside. So tennis shoes or sneakers or athletic shoes, those have high quality materials in them and they can be repurposed. So we're trying to create more of a circular economy or just reutilizing some of those resources instead of having them go to the landfill. So you can find us at a couple of different locations within the city. And what we do is we have a different drop-offs. So we have one for shoes. We have one for used clothing. Those fibers can be remade into new clothing. And those that are not of good quality, some of them are being shredded and turned into like insulation. You'll see that in packaging and mailing envelopes. They'll have organic fibers in them. And that is a insulator. We also recycle the food pouches, the Go-Go Squeeze, the Gerber. Children go through so many resources, and it's been a real breath of fresh air for a lot of parents who feel conflicted. Like my kids love these applesauces that you can squeeze, and they're very portable. They're great, but it's a mixed plastic, and you can't throw that into the recycling bin. But we have found and partnered with other organizations that can take those and they recycle them into different products. You can find a lot more of this information on our website at earthkeepers360.org. But we're trying to make another impact of how we can just be a little bit more sustainable in our community.
Yeah, and so those recycling centers, as Jen said, are, you know, at the Children's Museum, there's one. There's one at First Presbyterian Church down in the basement where you can recycle clothes and shoes, those food pouches. And there's a lot of opportunity there that we want to work with the community on. And if you're looking to have maybe one of those centers at your business or at your church or, you know, at some of the different places, you know, hit us up at Earthkeepers 360. Talk to Jen about maybe getting that set up where the community can drop that off. It's all free. And we do all the rest of the work for there. But, you know, it's part of us giving back to the future of generations, just like my daughter, who you heard on the radio just a second ago, and our daughter. And at the same time, you know, a chance to just kind of, you know, use science and technology to kind of help improve the world by recycling some of those hard items. The other thing that we kind of work on, and Jen, you know, this will be kind of the final question, is sure. Talk a little bit about climate smart congregations.
So our zero waste campaign is one portion of our climate smart congregation or climate smart communities. So we work with different churches. We can also work with different organizations. But it's really the combination of a community coming together to analyze whether it's their building or their community engagement and how to be more sustainable and reduce their carbon footprint. So when we do carbon smart or climate smart congregations, we look at the building, the energy audits, how to maximize energy efficiency and reduce energy costs. And that will also reduce the impact to the environment, as well as looking at different aspects of recycling, energy efficient appliances, removing things that shouldn't be turned on all day long, like your AV system. We talk about the five R's, the refusing, the reducing, the recycling, the rotting. We've instituted composting to a lot of different organizations. The preschool at our church, we have helped bring that to different congregations. Our public schools are now doing composting, which is amazing. So that we're just trying to find more ways to help people reduce their impact and hopefully save money as well, installing solar panels.
Yeah, so we work with a lot of congregations, a lot of temples all over the United States. One of the most interesting churches that we consulted with was actually up in Denver, Colorado at Montview Church, where they were asking how to get their social justice kits to be more environmentally friendly. And so the work that they do to give homeless lunches and things like that, they wanted to make more environmentally friendly. And so we worked to consult them on how to do that and how to bridge the gap between the ecology and social justice. And so that's one of the really important things that we obviously got involved in and, continue to help congregations all over the country in terms of that. And this is a bigger mission of First Presbyterian Church of Santa Fe. And we're grateful to be housed out of there, to make a difference on, with faith leaders and faith communities and to really stand up and to recognize conservation and ecological advocacy as part of our faith values and a part of a moral imperative of protecting our creation, part of the imperative we have to ensure that the planet is survivable and can thrive for future generations. And so that's a lot of the work we're going to do. We're going to go to commercial break, and after this break we're going to have on a secret mystery guest who is a former federal judge who's going to be talking about the Wild West of law out here in New Mexico and a little bit about some of the interesting cases he saw when he was on the federal bench.
Your favorite New Mexico classics, 99.9 FM and AM 810, weekdays from 9 to 11.
Well, good morning. Welcome back. This is Reverend Andrew Black, and I have the esteemed honor of welcoming in one of my favorite people. And of course, I'm incredibly biased, as I was with the last guest. But we have a federal judge in studio with us this morning. It's Judge Bruce Black, who's my father. A chance to get him on the radio. A lot of folks were interested in having him come and speak on the radio a little bit about his background in professionalism and kind of as a lawyer and a judge. But also, talk a little bit about New Mexico's storied history and kind of the Wild West and law and order. And so a lot of people don't realize that I serve First Presbyterian Church of Santa Fe, and that's actually where Billy the Kid's mother was married. So we have records showing William Bonney as one of the witnesses to that wedding. And of course, he's a storied outlaw and was once a lawman turned outlaw. But of course, Santa Fe holds amazing history like that as well as our whole state. So Judge Black, or as I call you, Dad, welcome to the studio, and it's an honor to have you. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your journey here to New Mexico, how you ended up here, and some of your early law partners.
All right. Well, my journey to New Mexico started when I was in college. I grew up in Michigan, in Detroit, which is a great city for a while. Not so great afterward. Good place to be from. But I knew I wanted to see more of the sun. So I decided I was going to come to New Mexico, Arizona. Interviewed several places in both states and came to Albuquerque, started there for about 5 years, came up here with Jack Campbell, former governor, and Jeff Bingaman, who later went on to become attorney general of the state and a U.S. senator.
So your first two law partners were Governor Campbell and Jeff Bingaman.
Great.
That's not a bad crew to hang out with.
Good place to start, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. One of my favorite stories, of course, of Jack Campbell was catching a state record brook trout that's actually hanging in La Fonda. Jack Campbell at the time didn't have a fishing license. And so he knew he had caught a state record brook trout. He knew it was, definitely going to be in contention for that state record. And then, of course, what do you do if you're a very esteemed person who doesn't have a fishing license and that's an illegal activity? And as it turns out that when Jack caught that state record brook trout that's hanging at La Fonda, and I'd recommend anyone who wants to go over to go see it, as it turns out that he was a senior and he didn't need a fishing license. And so there you go, folks. That's how the state record brook trout was caught and actually recorded, was by my dad's former law partner, Jack Campbell, who caught that fish without a license. But as it turned out, because of as being a senior in the state at that time, you didn't need a fishing license. And so that's kind of how the lore of that fish goes. And anyone who can tell good fish stories like that is always I'm a fan of. So,
yes.
You know, Bruce Black with us, joining us this morning. Talk to us a little bit about, so you went from practicing with Jeff Bingaman and Jack Campbell to becoming a state court judge. What did that look like for you, and how did you end up becoming a state court judge?
Well, I went with Jack and Jeff and started three person. Well, actually, they had started a slight before I came. And then in 1991, the Court of Appeals expanded to 10 judges. I'd practiced law for about 15 years then. And so I thought, well, I'll put my name in and see if I can get one of those three new spots. Bruce King made three appointments, Lynn Pickard, myself, and Benny Flores. And we went on the Court of Appeals, expanded from 7 to 10, and I served there for a little over 4 years.
And so you had to run for election. I remember growing up with a little bit of campaign politics. Tell me about that.
Indeed. At the time, you had to have so many signatures from each county in the state to get on the statewide ballot. So I had to go to various counties, and I had Nettie Harrelson, who was a great help, helping me go around the state, various counties, and get signatures. So I got on the ballot and ran in the Democratic primary with an opponent, and then I had no opponent in the general election. So it was quite an experience. We went to 30 counties. You and I went to a couple, and you got a lot of signatures for me. You had some colorful stories yourself about one of those signatures at La Fonda.
Yeah, sure did. So I remember many a days when I was about 10, 11 years old, going outside of a Walmart and getting signatures and making sure, asking people, what county do you live in, and are you a registered voter? And kind of, you know, that shaped a lot of my my early life. And I also remember going out to some really hot, dry desert areas and trying to dig a hole to put a sign in the ground.
That was in Lordsburg, I believe, outside of a bar.
Yeah, outside of a bar in Lordsburg. That is a memory that you will never forget as a young 10, 11-year-old boy of the heat of the desert of New Mexico, trying to dig in probably the hardest ground you've ever dug in, trying to get a campaign sign in. So that has very much shaped my political views and perspective in terms of life. But, you know, you went from being a state court of appeals judge to a federal judge. How does that work? How did that end up happening?
Well, I was not going to put my name in for federal judge. One of Jeff Bingaman's best friends, I think a roommate actually at Stanford, John Salazar, was going to put in for it. And I thought that's who Jeff should appoint. About 3 days before he was going to announce the appointment, John's wife saw what the salary of a federal judge was. And since he was practicing law in Albuquerque with a prominent firm, said, "You're not going to be a federal judge. We can't live on that." So he withdrew his name 3 days before. And I thought, well, if it's going to be somebody else, it might as well be me. And I put my name in, and Jeff appointed me. And under Bill Clinton, I was went to the Senate hearings and then went on to be appointed to a federal judgeship.
So you were appointed by President Clinton. You had to go under Senate confirmation. What was that process like?
It was kind of rough. Some of the Republicans had just taken over the Senate. So they were very feeling their oats. And they had some serious grilling for me when I went through the Senate confirmation hearings.
Yeah, as you might say, it's about as painful as a root canal, right?
About that, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so you know, you became a federal judge. You served down in Albuquerque. We ended up moving when I was a junior in high school down to Albuquerque because that's where your seat was, down at the federal courthouse there. Tell us a little bit about what the day-to-day life of a federal judge is, and then what were some of the cases that stuck out to you?
Well, the day life really is not all that exciting. You get a lot of, back then we had an awful lot of border crossing cases, and we went down to Las Cruces. Each of us took a month down there as we came down from Albuquerque because we had so many illegal reentries. And when I came on the bench, the rule was the first 18 times you were caught, they turned you around, buena suerte, and that was that. The 19th time they arrested you and you got a misdemeanor. Now the first time you come across the border, you get a felony arrest. So things have changed rather radically in that regard. After that, we had the usual mix of criminal cases. We had a lot of things. Judges from other districts said, "What are you doing trying murder cases? And those really aren't usually in federal court, or misdemeanor drunk drivings." But we had a lot of tribal jurisdiction. We did all the reservations. And, of course, we have 19 reservations here in this state, and that generated a good deal of our law as well. And then we had the usual mix of bankruptcies and things that come through
any federal court. You got all the tribal law through the Pueblos and through the Navajo Nation. That was a big part of the federal court docket, of course. And one of the interesting things, you know, you ended up having the Alaska Pipeline
I did.
Bomber.
Yeah, that case started in New Mexico, oddly enough, and it ended up being transferred to New Mexico, but it was a big case and it looked like it could be a very big case, but then it got transferred to Alaska and I had no more to do with it. I did have a few colorful characters, though, a fellow named Byron Shane Chubbuck. He deemed himself Robin the Hood, and he robbed 14 banks. I sentenced him to 20 years, and then he wanted another hearing on some obscure matter. He had managed to secrete a handcuff key in his body. I won't describe how that happened, but then he kicked out the door of the car taking him back to Santa Fe. The hearing was in Albuquerque. He kicked out the door, got loose, took a hostage at a gas station. He was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list for 3 or 4 months. The FBI came to his house, his apartment in North Albuquerque, thinking he was still in Mexico. And they were talking to his wife when they looked out, and here comes Chubbuck. He came up the stairs. They had a shootout. Both Chubbuck and the FBI agents emptied their revolvers from around back of a small apartment, and no one was hit. So that tells you how much adrenaline plays in a shootout. And he then was arrested. He came down. They put a police dog on him when he came down the stairs. The dog bit him, and he bit the dog. Then he was injured, obviously. He had to go to the BCMC those days. And on the way to the hospital, he had an IV in his arm. He ripped out the IV, knocked out the attendant, jumped out of the van, and escaped again.
Yeah, out of the ambulance.
Out of the ambulance, yes. He was quite a colorful character, to say the least.
Yep.
So, and he is now doing 70 years.
And the interesting thing is one of the ways that they caught him was him calling into the T.J. Trout radio show, and they were able to isolate his cell signal and figure out where he was. And a patrolman one night ended up having another shootout with him when he exited the premises where they kind of thought he was. So,
yeah, 4 in the morning, they had all kinds of squads out there trying to catch him and take him into custody, and he had another shootout with him when he went out to buy cigarettes. So he was definitely a colorful character.
Yeah, a little bit of the Wild West. You also had a very interesting experience of having to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you were called in as a special judge to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma?
Three of the Tulsa City Police were on trial, and none of the local judges wanted to be involved in that since Tulsa, like New Mexico, is a fairly small community, and they knew a lot of the people and would undoubtedly see them again in court. So they sent a judge over from New Mexico. We are in what's called the 10th Circuit, and that consists of Kansas, Oklahoma, Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah. And so judges are periodically called in from other districts to hear cases, but it was a very unsettling case for me because I thought it was clearly decided wrong by the Tulsa jury, but sometimes juries don't do what you think they'll do.
Well, there you go. Yeah, so it's, one of the things that you also pride yourself in is not just being a legal scholar and a judge, but also the opportunity to be a historian. You're a historian around civil rights or civil war history, but also love the history of New Mexico's law and order. And I was hoping you could share a few stories before we kind of, end this morning's program about kind of a little bit of the history of law and order in New Mexico.
Well, New Mexico was a pretty rowdy place in the 1800s. Certainly by the 1880s, after the Civil War, people started talking about the territory becoming part of the United States as a state. We were then linked with Arizona, so we were the New Mexico Territory, but included all of Arizona. And, of course, Billy Bonney, Billy the Kid, and there were several people that used Billy the Kid monikers during those days, but his was certainly one of the more notorious cases. But we had some federal judges, a guy named Kirby Benedict, who came to New Mexico from Illinois and was a friend of Abe Lincoln's and had been appointed to the territorial bench, but he had sort of a problem with the bottle, I think you could say. And he went over to Las Vegas, where they had a big gambling problem in those days, and they had a grand jury hand down indictments, and all the people are called in the gambling, and several of his buddies and poker playing partners were called before the bench, and he fined them $50. His name came up, and he stood up and said, "I plead guilty," and then he borrowed $50 from one of the lawyers and paid his fine. So that was the kind of judge. He was later on disbarred. He owned part of the New Mexican. It was a very colorful political character. People came to Abe Lincoln and said, "You got to replace this guy. He's just not good." And Lincoln said, "Well, I know Kirby Benedict well. I practiced law in Illinois, where he was frequently before the court." He said, Kirby Benedict knows more law drunk than anybody else in New Mexico sober, so I'm going to leave him on the bench.
There you go. So before we take a break, I also wanted to see if you would talk a little bit about El Fuego Baca and kind of that history of New Mexico. It's a really interesting story.
El Fuego Baca is a legend. I became a fan of his when I was about 10 years old. Walt Disney did a segment, and they used to have a weekly show, Disneyland, and he was on one of the characters they did, like Davy Crockett was also another. But El Fuego Baca was born in New Mexico in the 1880s, was allegedly kidnapped by natives who brought him back. That seems apocryphal to me, but he then went down to Mexico, rode with Pancho Villa, indeed stole one of Pancho Villa's revered ivory-handled pistols, for which he incurred Pancho's lasting enmity. He then came back to New Mexico, and as a 19-year-old kid before this, he had been from the Socorro area, and there's a little village called Frisco west of there. The cowboys, a lot of whom had been run out of Texas for legal reasons and stealing cattle, brought a lot of those cattle over to central New Mexico, and they were harassing a lot of people in Frisco. The sheriff said, I'm not going to get killed over this, so he ditched, and El Fuego said, well, that isn't right. You got to stop these guys. He went down to Frisco. He got the sheriff to nominate him as a deputy. Went down to Frisco, got into it, arrested one of the cowboys, which just stunned everybody because they had a big ranch and had as many as 80 or 90 cowboys working there. He took him to the magistrates, put him in jail. As he came out, the cowboys were not going to have any of this, so they started roughing him up, and he got loose, went to a little jacal, which was a basically wooden shed, and got the people who are living there to leave. He got into a shootout with the cowboys that lasted 24 hours. 4,000 bullets were fired. El Fuego outlasted 60 cowboys, and later on they figured out that the cow had a floor that was about 3 feet below where he could stick his head up, and he'd stick his hat on a pole and have it parade around. The cowboys kept shooting at it, hence the 4,000 bullets into the one broomstick had 8 bullets in it. It was quite a colorful character, and they could not imagine how he could possibly still be alive. The morning he put on some biscuits and coffee, and they saw smoke coming out, and they were just dumbfounded that this guy had managed to survive the night with all that firepower.
So how does he tie into the bigger New Mexico legal history?
He later on became a lawyer after reading 2 books on the law, which was all that was required in those days. He came to federal court frequently. It was a big favorite, a couple of judges, not so much the other judges, but one of his cases, he argued one of his clients had been caught with this during Prohibition with a bottle of old, old Cider Archer or something like that. And so the prosecution said, well, he must be guilty. He's got this, they call it whiskey. And he said, well, his argument was, you ever open it? You taste it? You don't know if it's whiskey. And he said, if I came into this courtroom and said I was Jesus Christ, would that make it so? And the jury exonerated his client.
Good lawyer, huh?
Yeah.
Shaped a lot of New Mexico's legal history.
He did do that.
Well, and it's one of the interesting things, too, that before we cut to break is, a lot of New Mexico's history is still alive in communities. You know, when I was working with Senator Bingaman, I used to cover Union County. And up there at the Union County Courthouse, there's a plaque for Black Jack Ketchum, who was a famous train robber out in the West. And one of the things that the plaque always surprised me of, and I think it just captures that, southwestern wit, it says, here swung Black Jack Ketchum into eternity, a good cowboy gone bad. And so I remember seeing that plaque up at Union County and just, reminding myself of how alive the history of the Wild West is still today. And that anyone who's ever been up to that Union County courthouse knows exactly that Wild West courthouse kind of feel. And the stories of El Fuego Baca or William Bonney are, of course, still alive in our communities today.
Black Jack Ketchum was hung, and he was about 250 pounds at the time, the last train robber hung in the country. And they had not done a hanging for quite a while in Union County, so they really didn't have anybody who knew what they were doing. When they dropped the trap door, they had put a little too much weight on Jack's feet and his weight, and his head popped off.
Oh, there you go.
And they made postcards of that and sold them across the country.
Yep, some definite vigilante justice there. So we'll take a break, and we'll come back for some final words from Federal Judge Bruce Black.
KSWV Radio, AM 810 and 99.9 FM. Translator K260CT, Santa Fe.
So we're here with Federal Judge Bruce Black, my father. I have the honor to interview him, which is kind of a unique opportunity of father and son. And one of the things a lot of people don't recognize is, you know, they know my dad is a judge, whether it was a state court of appeals judge or a federal judge. But one of the things they don't often know him as is a historian. So he got his master's from Western New Mexico down in Silver City, and then also had a chance to study over at University of Edinburgh in Scotland. So tell us a little bit about that.
That was a great adventure. 2012, after I'd just been the chief judge on the New Mexico federal court for the district, I had the opportunity to go over and study at University of Edinburgh. I'm not quite sure how I made that connection, but it was a great semester over there. I took a couple of courses, one on the American Revolution, which they are very careful not to use the word patriots. In fact, the first day he said, "We will not use call anyone here a patriot. We do have traitors." He wished to discuss that, and I had a great time in that course. And then the history of medicine, which is also interesting because several famous Brits had invented the microscope and other things that were very useful in medicine.
Yeah, so they framed the American Revolution over in Britain a little different.
Yeah, they see it a little differently.
I bet. So one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that your courthouse was the big stone courthouse downtown right there that's got the kind of inner rail around it. You want to talk about that inner rail and why that courthouse is stone?
Sure. We were trying to make a bid for statehood, and we wanted to show everybody in the East that we did not all live in brown mud huts. So we decided to have a big stone courthouse and impress them with the grandeur of it. The problem was nobody here knew how to lay stone. So we had to take several people. At the time, the troops from Missouri were coming in during the Mexican War, and they were on their way to California. They stayed here. The Kearney Code was our first law, and that's based on the law of Missouri. Kearney, General Kearney, as his family pronounces it. There's a street here in Santa Fe.
And a school.
Kearney. And a school, right. And he gave us the Missouri Code, and there were a couple of people in his regiments that knew were stone masons. So they were left here to try to start that courthouse. In 1862 or 3, Abe Lincoln gave us the choice of either paying taxes to support the Civil War or getting the money for the courthouse. And, of course, people here had all been Mexican citizens prior to that. And he knew nothing about paying taxes. We're not interested in that proposition. So the courthouse sat for 20 years. It was not funded. Eventually, they finished it. During the time, they had a big tricentennial, which was not really the history of Santa Fe, but close enough, in 1882, I believe. We were not founded in 1582, but they had horse races around the outside, what is now part of Paseo, and then coming around the courthouse. Those rails were for the horse track. That was, and as you can see, it's raised in some points. Allegedly, a little girl stepped in front of one of the mules in a mule race and was killed, and that little girl haunts the basement of the courthouse. So if you're there in the winter, particularly late at night, you'll be hearing a lot of creaking and groaning, which I attribute to the fact that it was originally designed to be a fireplace, heated courthouse, and they had to put in some retrofitting for things like a furnace. But it's got a lot of legend to that courthouse.
Yeah, indeed. And obviously, it houses the New Mexico State Legislature. You got a gallery in it in that courtroom. Right. And then, of course, the reason it being stone was to try to impress folks that everything didn't have to be built out of adobe. And so that's why you see that unique kind of stone courthouse downtown. And that, you know, a lot of people don't realize that big rail all along that park was originally a horse track. And so there's just really cool parts of our city's history that are, you know, kind of tie into the legal history. And the last thing I wanted to say, and this kind of ties into this weekend being Memorial Day weekend, is yesterday I had the amazing opportunity to receive a FedEx package that came all the way from Canada. And in that FedEx package was a thing that said, "I am now a Canadian citizen." And the reason I am now a dual citizen, United States citizen and Canadian citizen, is because of my grandfather, your father, who was born in Canada. And you want to talk a little bit about his background as a war veteran and also how this ties into your Canadian citizenship and mine.
Right. If you have a direct relative, a father or grandfather born in Canada, you are entitled to Canadian citizenship. Not quite the same test we use, but he was born in Montreal on the way over from Scotland. His parents were migrating to the Detroit area, but they lived in Montreal for about 5 years right after he was born. I had a real tough time finding his birth certificate because he was born at home, and they then filed it not with the state, but with the church. He had a baptismal certificate, and that's what they used back in those days in Montreal in 1916. So That's how he was a Canadian citizenship. I applied in 2017, become a Canadian citizen. I grew up in Detroit, which was really sort of a suburb of Canada. We went over to Windsor right across the river all the time for restaurants and ponies at the trotting track and other things. But, so I wanted to become a Canadian citizenship, got mine, and then they passed a recent law for you to get yours.
Yeah, literally grandfather clause. So one of the things that's really interesting, though, is how he became a U.S. citizen. So how did Papa Bill, as I would call him, or William Black, how did he become a U.S. citizen?
During the war, the Second World War, he enlisted in the Army, and they gave him citizenship as part of the troops that went with Patton across the channel and fought all the way into Berlin.
Yeah, so it's one of the really interesting stories, obviously tying into Memorial Day. Papa Bill, William Black, is buried up at the National Cemetery here in Santa Fe, honoring a lot of our veterans, those who gave the greatest sacrifice, of course, this weekend for Memorial Day. We had last week, it was Military Appreciation Day. And we, of course, started this week off talking to Dave Trujillo and to Anthony Castillo about fly fishing and veterans program around that. And so I thought it was a really interesting thing in our own family. You know, my mother's side, Papa George, was in the U.S. Navy, is one of the first frogman, fought in World War II as well. But Papa Bill became a U.S. citizen via conscription and joining the Army and going with General Patton across Europe and liberating a lot of Nazi concentration camps. Obviously a brutal, brutal reality. He won a Silver Star and Bronze Star and Purple Heart in that campaign and very much shaped how both of us and our lives are in terms of our public service and willing to give back to community. So we remember those stories. We remember those roots and kind of the deep roots in Santa Fe of kind of those military history. And of course, want to, you know, send all our thoughts and prayers out to those who are going to be at the National Cemetery this weekend on the hill on Santa Fe, and remembering all of our veterans and those who paid the greatest sacrifice this weekend as we head into Memorial Day. So have a safe Memorial Day, have a safe graduation weekend. And it's just been an honor and a pleasure to be with you all here again, Andrew Black. And I want to thank Estevan Gonzalez. I want to thank George and Aya for really holding down the board and keeping things going at this station, making sure we didn't lose airtime. And just really thank you all for taking a chance to listen and to have some entertaining guests this week. And thanks to all of our guests who joined us.